Chapter 6. Sal Sarducci stood in the shadows across the street from the factory owned and operated by Trask Industries. He checked his watch. 1 a.m.
The little shit in his cohorts will make their move soon, he thought bitterly.
The few lights outside the sprawling building had been turned off to conserve electricity and perhaps thwart a Japanese bombardier from seeing a target. He looked up at the shifting clouds. It would be so much easier if the Japanese did bomb Trask Industries, but no chance of that tonight. Even if they were capable of such an act, which he doubted, no one would fly in this weather. He had seen no one nearby for over an hour. No light emanated from the few windows dotting the factory walls. He saw no obvious signs of workers inside, no lines of parked bicycles or cars outside. He didn't want to be a part of anything that involved hurting innocent people. He'd seen too much violence in his life, and he abhorred it. He realized sometimes it became necessary, but he didn't think tonight should qualify. A simple arson job in the dead of night. He felt the weight of his service revolver in the shoulder holster and hoped he wouldn't have to use it. Movement caught his attention. Three dark shapes approached the corner of the building he stood across from. He could tell by their amateurish stalking movements that this could only be Miles and two of his mates. He fought the urge to step from the shadows and yell at them to just act natural. Sneaking and stalking only drew attention if anyone watched.
Idiots, he seethed to himself.
He tried to talk Victor into letting him do the deed instead of these dolts, but Victor always had a plan, and he wanted young Miles to not only prove his loyalty, but also give Victor leverage over him. Indeed, Sal witnessing the whole thing was a part of that. The other two men were Miles' friends. Neither worked at Brooks Industries. Miles brought them in, assuring him they'd keep quiet. The three men stopped at the corner, and Sal heard sniggering laughter.
My God, they're drunk, he muttered quietly.
He heard the lead man, presumably Miles, shushing the other two hooligans. They shaped up and moved along the wall as though stalking an unsuspecting friend. Sal scanned the area. It remained thankfully devoid of life. Even a hapless passerby would wonder what the three of them were up to. They stopped at the first door they came to, and Sal heard them trying it. Locked. A light from a small flashlight lit up the door. They had the sense to lean in and squelch the light with their bodies in heavy trench coats. But if someone was watching, they'd certainly notice them. Sal had showed Miles how to defeat a simple door lock using a pick and blade. Miles had paid attention, and Sal observed him successfully open four locked doors. He hoped he remembered his lessons now that it counted. 2 minutes later, the door opened and the three of them disappeared inside. Sal checked his watch again. This shouldn't take long, no more than 5 minutes if they don't play grab-ass with each other. A car's headlights swung into the parking lot and lit up the front of the factory. Sal kept one eye shut to preserve his night sight as he watched the car sit there for a full minute with the engine idling. Finally, the driver's side door opened, then loudly shut. He hoped the boys inside heard it, but doubted it.
Get out of there, he hissed to himself.
They'd been in there for at least 5 minutes.
What were they doing in there? He wondered.
He watched the driver walk quickly to the front of the building's main entrance. The car still idled. Is someone still inside the vehicle? Sal heard a set of keys jangling.
Janitor?
He shook his head. A janitor wouldn't be driving such a nice car. Most likely wouldn't be driving at all. Not with the price of gasoline. And letting the car idle instead of shutting it down? Whoever owned it had money and clout. Maybe it was Harry Trask himself. Sal stayed on his side of the street, but walked casually along the sidewalk, keeping to the darkest areas. He stopped when he came abreast of the car. He could hear the engine's low hum. Light shone out from the front of the factory. He knew from an earlier reconnaissance that the front of the factory had two stories of office space, and he saw a top-floor light snap on. Obviously, whoever was inside didn't intend to be there long, unless there was someone else in the car with the heater on. The side door where Miles and the others had gone in suddenly burst open, and the three of them spilled out, laughing. Before they shut the door, Sal saw the soft glow of firelight. Sal watched the three of them stumble along the wall, slapping one another on the back as though they'd just won a hard-fought croquet match. None of them noticed the beaming headlights at the front. Sal smelled a hint of smoke, and he thought he saw a wisp seeping through the gap in the metal ceiling at the far corner. It wouldn't be long before the flames engulfed the entire structure. Sal heard the passenger door open and shut, and his blood turned cold. Shit. He saw someone step in front of the headlights, and he realized she wore a dress. Probably Trask's wife, or if not Trask, another bigwig in the company. He glanced back toward the Three Stooges just as they rounded the far corner. He turned back to the woman just as she got to the corner and looked their way. But even if they'd have been there, she wouldn't be able to see much beyond the glare of the headlights. Will she see the fire? If they alerted the fire department, they'd be there in minutes and ruin Victor's plans. But if Sal intervened, they'd know this wasn't an accident. "I'm not killing anyone," Sal reminded himself. The woman startled and turned toward the front doors. Sal saw the driver locking the factory door behind him. He looked to be in a rush. Whatever business he had, it must have been terribly important to venture out this late, but Sal didn't have time to wonder about that. "Get in the damn car and drive away," he tried to will it to happen.
"What are you doing out of the car, my dear? You'll catch your death,"
Sal heard the driver say. She pointed and raised her voice above the idling engine.
"I heard something. Like laughing."
The driver strode to her side, and Sal watched him put his arm around her waist. He couldn't hear what they said to one another, but the man peered along the path of the headlights. Sal could see a distinct glow coming from the far corner now. Even in the headlights, it would be tough to miss. The driver hesitated for a moment, then yelled,
"Christ almighty! Fire!"
The woman screamed and asked with rising hysteria,
"What do we do?"
The man ran to the front door and struggled to find the correct key. His wife screamed,
"Don't go inside! What are you doing?"
"There's a phone inside. I'll call the fire department." He dropped the keys and lost them in the shadows for a moment. As he searched for them, the woman yelled,
"Forget the phone! They're right around the corner on 15th and Black Oak. Let's drive there!"
"Found him!" he yelled triumphantly. He tried to insert the key in the door, but the woman threw herself at him and screamed,
"Don't go inside! I can see smoke! Please, Harry!"
Sal watched his indecision from the shadows. Finally, the woman prevailed, and they both entered the car and roared off with screeching tires and shooting bits of gravel.
"Good choice."
He ran to the door Miles had entered and felt the doorknob. It felt warm, but not hot yet. He carefully opened the door and a wave of heat blew in his face. He peered inside. The fire licked up the far walls and had spread to machines and conveyor belts, hungrily consuming the oily surfaces. Sal wiped the inside and outside doorknob with a handkerchief, relocked it, and closed it with a hard pull. Then he trotted back across the street and disappeared into the shadows. Clyde and Abby exited the cab in front of a block of row houses. Each small residence shared a wall with neighbors on either side. A low, white picket fence separated the tidy front yards from the street. Clyde paid the cabbie and looked around his old neighborhood. He talked with his mother on the phone she could access at her workplace, but hadn't had a chance to come to the house in over a month. He dreaded it now. He knew his parents were out of their heads worrying about Frank. Clyde worried too, but there was nothing he could do to help him, so he tried to put it out of his mind. He'd written him letters, but doubted they'd ever find their way to him. No one had heard from him since Pearl Harbor. He didn't want to think about losing him, and coming here would just remind him that his brother might already be dead. Abby put her arm through his, and they walked to the front gate of number 8 Elkton Street. The curtains shifted in the single bottom floor window. A moment later, the front door swung open, and out burst Clyde's mother, Cecilia. Her broad smile and cherry-red cheeks glowed. She wiped her thick hands on her apron and rushed down the concrete steps.
"Oh, Clyde, you're here. I've missed you so much."
Clyde unlatched the little gate door and held it open for Abby. A sizable black-and-white dog pushed through the front door and lunged past Cecilia. He slammed into Clyde's legs, and Clyde got to his knees and rubbed the dog's furry face vigorously. "Did you miss me, Klondike? Huh?" Klondike spun circles in elation. Cecilia scolded him. "Honestly, Clyde, give your mother a hug before that mangy mutt." Clyde went to his mother. He embraced her in a bear hug and lifted her stout frame off the ground. Cecilia laughed. He put her back on her feet, and she went to Abigail, who was petting Klondike and trying to keep him from pushing through her legs. "Oh, my dear Abby, it's so good to see you again. It's been far too long." "I agree wholeheartedly, Mrs. Cooper." She waved her hand at her. "Cecilia, or if you like, Cece. We're family. You know that." She pulled Abby into a tight embrace and swung her side to side. Abby laughed, not used to such open affection from her elders. Cecilia stepped away and looked her up and down. "You're a rail. Haven't you been eating?" Abby held out her hands and swung the hems of her dress. "I'm watching my figure to keep your son's interest." Cecilia reared her head back, laughing, and said, "You won't have to work too hard on that. You're stunning as usual." Abby blushed and said, "Thank you. You look well too, Cece." The neighbor's front door opened, and an elderly woman leaned out and exclaimed,
"Is that Clyde Cooper?"
Clyde grinned and said, "Yes, it is, Mrs. Graves. How are you?" The woman's silver hair sat atop her head in swirls, and wooden pegs stuck out at various angles. As a boy, he always marveled at how many she could pull out when she started digging around for them. She said,
"Well, I'm fine. Where in the world have you been, young man? Don't you know your mother's been worried sick?"
Clyde glanced at his mother, who simply shrugged. He said, "Work's been busy with the war and all." He stepped back and touched Abby's hand.
"This is Abby. You remember meeting her at the wedding?"
Mrs. Graves looked affronted.
"Well, of course I do. I'm old, but I'm not senile."
Her smile grew, and she lifted her chin to Abby.
"Lovely to see you again, dearie.
And you, Mrs. Graves. How's the knitting coming along?"
She looked positively thrilled.
"You remembered. It's going well."
She winked and said in a more conspiratorial tone,
"You let me know when you're expecting, and I'll knit the baby a nice warm blanket."
Abby blushed again, and Cecilia scolded Mrs. Graves.
"Honestly, Millie, you're making her blush."
She shooed her away.
"Get along now. You're taking time away from my visit."
She turned her back to Mrs. Graves and held out her hands for Abby and Clyde to come inside. Klondike pushed in at the last moment. His claws clicked and ticked as he ran across the wood floor and picked up a toy. With his tail going a mile a minute, he dropped it at Abby's feet, and his eyes went from hers to the toy and back again.
"Honestly, that dog's crazy," Cecilia said. "I can put him in the back if you want, dear."
Abby rubbed the back of his ear and said,
"He's fine. He's a very good boy."
"He misses the boys." Cecilia's eyes took on a faraway look. Clyde took his mother in his arms and they hugged. When he pulled away, tears sparkled at the edges of her eyes. He asked, "Any word?" But he already knew the answer. She shook her head and he said,
"Me neither. I just feel so helpless," she said as she wrung her hands in her apron. "It's been almost 2 months now without a word. It's not like him.
Has anyone heard anything? I mean, Sammy's over there, too. Have his parents heard anything?" Clyde asked hopefully.
"No. Sally thinks it's a good sign, actually. She thinks if something had..."
She hesitated.
"Happened to them, we would have heard."
She wiped the tears threatening to spill down her cheeks.
"I think she's right. Remember the Braddocks?"
"Sure I do. Billy Braddock, right?" She nodded slowly.
"They got a telegram."
She couldn't finish, and the tears welled up again.
"You mean..."
Clyde asked. Cecilia couldn't speak, but she nodded. He sat down heavily on the sofa and ran his hands through his hair. Abby stopped rubbing Klondike's ears and asked,
"A telegram?"
"Delivered by a priest from the army," Cecilia could finally say.
"Oh, my God," whispered Clyde.
Abby went to him and rubbed his shoulder.
"You know him?"
He shrugged. "Not like Sammy, but he's a neighborhood kid. Lives a block away on Stewart." Tears sparkled in Abby's eyes now.
"How awful. I hate this war."
Her hard voice pulled Clyde from the thoughts of Billy Braddock. He stood and took his wife into his arms.
"Me too, darling. Me too."
Clyde's father, Sidney, arrived from his job on the wharf, and after a quick greeting and a shower to get the fish smell off, which never really came off, they sat around the modest dinner table. Cecilia brought out dish after delicious dish and placed them wherever they'd fit.
"Wow, Cece, this smells amazing!" Sidney exclaimed in wonderment.
Abby couldn't keep from smiling.
Clyde saw her smiling and asked, "What's so funny?"
"Your father sounds exactly like you, except Cece's food actually deserves the praise."
"Pshaw, you're getting better every day," he countered.
"You're sweet." Sidney gave his son a knowing look.
"He better be sweet, or I'll give him what for."
He grinned, making his thick, dark mustache spread out.
"If he ever isn't, you let me know, Abby. Deal?"
She laughed.
"Deal."
She looked lovingly at Clyde and said, "But I doubt I'll ever have to take you up on that." Cecilia brought the last dish out and sat down across from her husband. She held out her hands.
"Join hands while Sid leads us in thanks."
Sid kept it short and sweet, but ended with, "And God, please look out for Franklin and keep him well while he's fighting those godless Japanese. Amen." A resounding amen from all of them, and they dug into the food. The conversation centered on Sidney's work at the wharf, then on Clyde's work at the paper. They hinted at the war here and there, but there was very little good news there, so they avoided the topic. They kept Frank's name out of the conversation, too. It was simply too hard to talk about and still maintain an appetite. They ate the delicious food until they could eat no more. Clyde leaned back and rubbed his distended belly.
"Thank you, Mom. That was amazing."
She beamed.
"Thank you, son, but I wouldn't get used to it. They're rationing things at the stores."
Abby chimed in.
"I've noticed that too. All sorts of things."
Sidney added,
"Well, it's the very least we can do, I suppose."
"Yes, of course," Abby agreed.
Clyde lurched forward and blurted, "I've joined the army." Silence settled over the table like a dark shroud. Abby reached under the table and felt for his hand. He gripped it tightly. Cecilia broke the silence first. In a monotone, she asked,
"Were you drafted?"
"No. I volunteered, so they wouldn't just put me any old place."
Sidney asked, "The press corps? Reporter?"
"No, sir. I've been corresponding with Cousin Sean. I'm joining the paratroopers." Sidney dropped his fork, and it clattered on the plate and bounced onto the floor. Klondike moved in quickly and licked it clean.
"Paratroopers?
I don't understand. Why them? You don't seem the type." Clyde flushed and stammered.
Not the type? What do you mean by that?"
Sidney's eyes hardened and he leaned on the table with both elbows.
"I mean you're too smart for that. You should be a clerk or something. You've got some college. Paratroopers? They'll put you on the front line, son."
Both Cecilia's and Abby's eyes went wide.
Abby blurted, "It will? But Sean said he doubts they'll ever see combat. In fact, he thought he made a mistake by joining."
She looked desperately at Clyde for support.
"Isn't that right, Clyde?"
"Yes," he squeezed her hand. "Yes, absolutely."
Sidney rubbed his forehead, then said,
How would your cousin know? He ain't the smart one. You are. They're considered elite troops, right?
Clyde shrugged.
Just because they're doing something new. You know, jumping out of airplanes. It's dangerous, so they're considered elite, I guess. But he thinks they'll just be used as an exhibition.
Abby added,
Yes, and Daddy thinks they're only being put together to show the Germans that we've got airborne troops, too. It'll keep them on their toes.
Sidney's voice lowered, and his eyes showed deep concern as he said, The Germans have had success using them. What makes you think the army won't try the same? Clyde felt backed into a corner now. Well, it's already as good as done. Cecilia looked even more alarmed.
What do you mean?
I've already signed up. The recruitment office said I could request airborne, and that's what I did.
You already signed up for the paratroopers? Sidney asked.
Clyde nodded, and Sidney's voice lowered an octave, and he spoke slowly.
They own you now, Clyde. They'll put you where you're needed, despite what some recruiter told you. Didn't you listen to anything your brother said about this stuff? Hell, they promised him he'd be an aircraft mechanic.
Clyde sputtered.
But that was before the war.
He looked at Abby, whose face had taken on a pale tone.
Abby's father, Victor, said he'd get me in the unit even though I'm married. He knows some bigwig generals, and he said he'd grease the skids for me.
Sidney and Cecilia exchanged a look, which didn't go unnoticed by either Clyde or Abby. Sidney sighed and said, Well, it's probably better than the regular infantry. He stood and went to the mantel. He picked up the framed picture of Frank in his pressed U.S. Army uniform.
Two of you in the damn army during a world war.
He shook his head sadly.
God help us.
The first half of the cab ride home they spent in earnest silence. The evening hadn't gone as planned. After Clyde broke the news about joining the paratroopers, Cecilia couldn't keep from tearing up. Clyde felt awful. Finally, Abby said,
I'll talk to my father. He can simply undo this whole thing. You can get a job as a foreman at the factory and be exempt from military service.
Clyde looked at his lap and picked his fingernails.
I can't do that, Abby. It'll just prove his point. What point? She asked, exasperated.
He already thinks I'm useless. If I go begging him to keep me out of the war...
Well, I just can't do that. I'd lose my self-respect. Your self-respect? What about your life? What about our life? What about starting our family?
He stared out the window. Rain poured down, and the wiper blades flicked quickly from side to side, but couldn't keep the windshield clear for long. He finally turned back to her.
I'd lose your respect, too.
She shook her head, and he cut her off before she could protest.
I would. You don't think so now, but it would happen. People would whisper, and over time it would affect us, affect our marriage, our love.
Abby lowered her head, and tears streamed down her cheeks and splashed onto her lap.
What if I get one of those telegrams? What'll I do then?
He gently lifted her chin and wiped a tear off her cheek with his thumb. She looked at him pleadingly.
I don't want to lose you, Clyde.
You won't, Abby. This war will be over in a year. By then, I'll just be getting done with training. She erupted angrily.
You don't know that. You keep saying that, but you don't know anything. None of us do.
The cabbie eyed them through the rearview mirror. Clyde pulled her into his shoulder, and her tears wetted his coat. He stroked her dark hair.
You're right, Abby. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't want to go. You know how I feel about this useless war.
She wiped her tears and asked,
You still feel that way? Even after Pearl Harbor?
He hesitated. Before Pearl Harbor, his strong convictions against the war were solid. But now? I'm conflicted, he finally stammered. My brother's life is on the line because of them. They attacked us before they'd even declared war. A cowardly and underhanded act if ever there was one. It's hard not to hate them. His voice calmed as he formed his thoughts. At the paper, I'm surrounded by it all day. Everyone wants revenge, and they're willing to kill. At least they say they are, but I wonder about that. At the end of the day, the Japanese are still people. I mean, the soldier? He's just a cog in the wheel. If there was just some way we could kill the people actually responsible.
The young men always fight the wars. The soldiers, Abby said softly. They do the dying.
I don't want to kill anyone, Abby. I just want to stay here with you and start a family. She snuggled into him, and he took the scent of her hair in, a mix of roses and cinnamon.
But I can't. I've already signed up, and I think it was the right thing to do.
He kissed the top of her head. We'll get through this, Abby. I feel like I'm at the starting line of a race, and even though I'm not a runner, I can't back out of running it.
A high hurdles race, she added.
He squeezed her and agreed.
Yes.
Good thing is it's not a marathon. A few days later, Clyde and Abby stood on the bus station platform. Beside him, Clyde had his packed suitcase full of clothes and toiletries. He didn't really know what he'd need, but he kept it light, assuming the army would supply him with most everything. Just a few days prior, he'd reported to the induction center. Nurses and doctors searching for anything that would make him ineligible for service had poked and prodded him relentlessly. He'd hoped they'd find something, but knew they wouldn't. For once in his life, he cursed his good health. After a long day, those that had passed stood at attention with their right hands raised and swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. Staring at the piece of paper they'd given him stating his new identity as Private Clyde Cooper hit him square in the gut. He belonged to the U.S. Army now. The bus station teemed with people. Families hugged their sons and brothers, wives hugged and kissed their men, and children openly wept as they said goodbye to their fathers. Clyde held Abby fiercely, as though she'd blow away with a strong wind. She hugged him back just as fiercely. She dolled herself up as best she could, and Clyde wondered once again how he'd made her his wife. A nearby couple jostled them, and Clyde nearly tripped over his suitcase. They separated and stared into one another's eyes.
I'll write you every chance I get, he said.
You better, she jabbed him in the gut.
Don't let them make you too skinny.
I doubt that'll be up to me. He looked around at all the goodbye scenes playing out all around them. He turned back to her and touched her belly. He leaned in close and said into her ear,
Maybe it happened last night.
She kissed his cheek.
I hope so with all my soul.
Me too. Remember to reach out to my mom and dad if you need anything. They're not rich, but they'll do anything for you. They both love you so much.
And I love them, Clyde.
A tear formed in the corner of her eye, and she quickly wiped it away. He said, Don't cry. I can't stand to see you sad. Besides, Fort Lewis isn't far. I'm just down the road.
I told myself I wouldn't cry.
She steeled herself and fixed his wrinkled shirt.
You better go, or I'm going to completely lose it.
He picked up his bag and took a half step back from her. She held up her left hand and spun the gold wedding ring he'd given to her. He'd bought what he could afford, promising to one day buy her something more lavish, something worthy of her. She kissed the ring, something she did sometimes when they couldn't embrace.
I'll kiss this every night, my darling.
He kissed his simple gold band. I doubt they'll let me keep it on during training, but I'll think of you every day. I love you, Abigail Vera Cooper. The nearly uninterpretable voice from the bullhorn-wielding bus station employee told him it was time to board. He stood next to the door and turned around for one last look. She lifted her chin and gave him a radiant smile. He could see tears shimmering in the corners of her eyes, and he felt as though someone had torn out his guts.
"Wait for me,"
he whispered to himself. She kissed her ring again and waved. He waved back and stepped onto the bus. Moments later, a corporal stood at the front of the bus and called off their names one by one, reading from a clipboard. Satisfied, he said with a sneer,
"Relax. Once we arrive at Fort Lewis, you won't get another chance. You're in the Army now."
He sat down, and the inductees exchanged worried glances.